Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. 2 weeks from Wednesday, the day after the primary election that will help set the table to decide, among other things, who our next mayor will be, Baltimore will mark the one-year anniversary of the violence and uprising that erupted after the funeral of Freddie Gray, who, as you know, died in police custody. We're having a series of conversations leading up to that anniversary about the state of our city before and since that cataclysmic week that began on April 27th last year. Now we turn to two women who are at the forefront of organizing and affecting the kind of change that so many people think is long overdue in a city that, like many cities in the United States, has tremendous inequality drawn along racial and economic lines. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore, an organization that aspires to empower and inform community organizers, educators, and people across Baltimore's nearly 300 neighborhoods. Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities, which advocates on public policy and targets philanthropy to make middle and low-income communities healthier and more prosperous. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
So, Diane Bell McCoy, there have been no shortage of panels and symposiums and reports and political conversations about the problems of inequality and the problems that underlie the unrest from last year. Everybody from arts organizations to policy wonks. You're going to be leading another panel. We're going to talk about that in a minute at a thing called the Neighborhood Institute, which takes place on Saturday. You are very close to the ground about what's going on in this town. What, in your estimation, has happened in this last year? Has the ball been moved forward substantially since April 27th last year?
I think the ball's been put in play. That's what I would say. The ball's been put in play. Has it been moved substantially? I don't think that's true. And I think what happens after this will be up to all of us in Baltimore from every walk of life, whether or not we can continue to move it forward, because it's a very complicated process to change these kind of wealth disparities in our city, in many cities.
And has the conversation changed? I mean, with the ball in play now, are we speaking about this? Are we considering this, ruminating on it in a different way than we were before the violence?
I think those organizations that I think there are different organizations looking at it differently. And I think everyone is using their lens to look at it differently. I think the challenge will be, how do we move the ball forward? Do we find a way with a collective set of lens to look at the issue? Because looking at it from each one of our individual lens is not going to take us to a collective that's going to benefit all of us in a greater way. And I think it requires both work on the ground and certainly the work that Strong Cities is doing in terms of making a difference with a host of other organizations, Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, organizing, advocacy. But it's going to take a difference by looking at policies and how do we have a different set of policies? How do we stop policies from being promulgated the way they are? How do we pay attention to the impact, long-term impact of structural racism? So it's a very multi-level effort that's going to have to take place. And it's going to include our business community. Many of them have stepped up already. A number of them are still continuing because everybody's clear that if we don't figure this out now, it really does hurt all of us in a very collective way. And we're going to have some tough conversations around race, tough conversations around those wealth disparities. And that's a little difficult for us as a city and many cities. But for Baltimore, I think it's a little bit of a challenge in terms of understanding what we had to see happen that for many people didn't know was existing in our city.
Absolutely. And Karen Stokes, part of the Neighborhood Institute that's going to take place on Saturday is designed to have that conversation, to ask those tough questions and to help people start coming up with answers. This is the ninth year that you've done it. Tell us what's involved in this, who you're going to bring together, what kinds of stuff you're going to talk about.
We have it at the Baltimore Design School, which is a wonderful example, actually, of community-based development. And the people who come together in this particular venue are actual community residents. This is very grassroots. We expect about 300 neighborhood leaders, people who other folks are cultivating as potential neighborhood leaders. They are folks who are community activists, people who care about their neighborhoods. Most people in Baltimore, regardless of where you go, people do deeply care about where they live. What we're trying to do is give people some hands-on tools to make a difference. How do they make those changes? And what's unique about this, I believe, is that we're bringing together all these various neighborhood activists, from people who may live in the Oliver community or in Park Heights, Roland Park, South Baltimore, York Road corridor. And this is an opportunity for leaders to talk to each other as well. So they're going to be, we have 27 workshops planned. There will be over 50 presenters. Many of our presenters are people who actually do the work themselves out in the community. And we have an opportunity for people both to hear. All of our workshops are about an hour long, and we provide resources across the board for anything that any neighborhood organization, association might need, you probably can find at this institute.
It's a one-stop shopping.
It is. That's how we envision it.
Yeah. And Diane Bell McCoy, you're going to be kicking this off on Saturday with a panel talking about building community wealth. What do we mean by community wealth? And is community wealth building a matter of money, a matter of dollars, or does that definition extend to other ways of being wealthy?
I think it's much more encompassing than dollars. Certainly community wealth is a big part of that, is changing the dollar outcome. But I think it's also about the wealth that we have, as Karen just talked about, even in terms of our citizens, that we don't often think about that as part of community wealth. But making sure that we lift up that kind of leadership that's a part of our neighborhoods and building community wealth. But when you think about community wealth, you think about some things that historically we haven't always accepted that we're a part of building community wealth, including resident-led businesses in terms of that kind of engagement. Even as we think about community wealth from standpoint of our anchor institutions making a difference of lending their power, their wealth in terms of helping small businesses be able to get more business and doing more in that community, giving a leg up. It's about housing, but it's also about the pathway to that. It's about retaining that. Community wealth is a collective in terms of how do we increase the economic outcomes in this city. And I am excited about the panel. I'm excited about Strong Cities in terms of this opportunity to have this kind of dialogue. And sometimes I think the dialogue will also be tough to have in terms of what I define as community, what I believe are my assets, which versus another neighborhood believes are their assets. But that's the space that we can have that kind of conversation, and that becomes an important way to have the conversation about building community wealth.
Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore. The Neighborhood Institute will take place on Saturday on 88.1 WIPR. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So Karen Stokes, your organization began after the last set of riots we had.
Indeed.
In 1968.
Yes.
At that time, it was called the Greater Homewood Neighborhood Association. You changed it just a year or so ago to Strong City. I wonder, we have something like 278 separate neighborhoods in the city of Baltimore. And people often point to that with pride, and we're a city of these, you know, individual communities. But I wonder, given the fact that, you know, a kid growing up or being born in Harlem Park has a life expectancy that's 20 years shorter than the kid being born in Roland Park, is it to our advantage? Is it advisable for us to be thinking about these individual enclaves, these individual groups of neighbors, rather than thinking about the city as a whole?
Well, I think we do both, and that is partly why we changed our name, because we have been citywide really for the past decade. I think what Diane mentioned earlier about the collective is really important. Neighborhoods are great because they have a certain kind of sense, you know, one neighborhood to another, there's a difference. Like, you know, the Barclay neighborhood is clearly very different in some ways in Bolton Hill, both in terms of the housing structures, and there's a lot of differences about it. But what is also clear that neighborhood boundaries are, in many ways, often irrelevant. Crime doesn't stop at one boundary. We have to actually work across these neighborhoods. And the work of my organization as an intermediary has always been, we have community associations and neighborhood associations. What we see is, how do we connect those folks along, you know, with each other? So you drive up Calvert Street as an example, and I know that community is really looking about traffic calming. Well, it affects lots of neighborhoods all along the way. When a new library comes in, you know, it may affect four or five different neighborhoods. So you really need to provide some training and help for neighborhood leaders to figure out, how do we build a coalition? We're a lot more powerful when we are organized as a community. So number one, this institute's about really talking about power and talking about the fact that if you're not organized, if you don't have your block organized and your neighborhood organized, you will be overlooked. But then in addition to that, how do you get organized across those neighborhood boundaries? And we create coalitions, and we see those very effectively happening, whether it's the No Boundaries Coalition over in West Baltimore, the York Road Partnership. There's coalitions that can also be useful.
One of the things that I like about the work of Strong Cities, and I know this is tough space as well for so many of us, is that this year there is a conversation in terms of about the racial inequities. So although, yeah, we do have lots of ways of coming together and finding out ways to create a collective, there is an unevenness in terms of even capacity by virtue of a Sandtown versus a Roland Park. That's just a reality. In terms of by accepting that reality, by putting that reality on the table and beginning to understand what that means from a structural standpoint of barriers, I think that's the way we will actually be able to move the agenda forward. Because it's not ignoring the differences, it's celebrating the things we have in common, but it's also acknowledging that we've got structural barriers that come from the history of our city that has created the disparities, particularly around race and wealth that we have. And that's something I really want to say that I'm very proud that Strong Cities has put it on the table. They're not running away from it.
Because I've talked to scholars, I've talked to organizers. I've talked to people like Davon Love, you know, from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I've talked to the police. I've talked to lots of people. And it seems to me that we have a gap in racial inequality. We have a gap in economic inequality. We have a gap in opportunity, equality. We also have a gap in compassion. And so when we talk about the difference between Berkeley and Bolton Hill, one of the differences, it seems to me, is that the folks in Bolton Hill, who are generally speaking more affluent than the folks in Berkeley, don't have a visceral reason to care about the people in Berkeley. And it's almost everybody agrees that the only way that this thing really gets fixed is when people who have resources care in a fundamental way about the folks who don't. What is the argument to the people in Roland Park, the people in Guilford and in Homeland, to care about the Red Line not being built, to care about the job opportunities and the health disparities in Sandtown, Winchester? How do you make that case to them?
I would begin by saying that I think that challenge is a challenge for us as a country. We still live with our myths. We live with our myths as Americans in terms of a Pew Charitable Trust just came out with a study that talked about 65% of this country still believes that everybody can make it by climbing up with their own bootstraps, when in fact 85% of the wealth is owned by very small. So that's a myth in this country. So we've really had to begin to dispel the myths about that, dispel the myths about the impact of structural racism, that what happened 40, 50, 60 years ago still has an impact now. But I think all that has to be part of the conversation with different communities that have more assets. But you also have to help them understand that their bottom line, their taxes, their bottom line in this city gets impacted by not paying attention. But you have to help them understand that people in those other communities that they think, those people are not broken. I say this all the time to people, first of all, that black and brown people are not broken, that systems and policies are broken, and they created that brokenness. So it really is a multi-level education to help people understand that their interconnectedness, our success as a city, relies upon can we change those outcomes. Yeah. And we have the power to do that.
Well, I do think that the institute that you're having on Saturday is going to go a long way to help fix whatever's broken. And I appreciate both of you all coming by and break a leg on Saturday. Enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore. Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Ms. McCoy will lead a panel on Saturday morning that kicks off the 9th Annual Neighborhood Institute. Panelists will include Peter Sabonis of the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, David Hong from the Living Design Lab, and Heather Mazura, former member of the Maryland House of Delegates and candidate for governor in the 2014 Democratic primary. We've got a link to Strong City Baltimore's website with complete information about the Neighborhood Institute. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, Sheila Cass talks to Dennis Ross, the former Middle East envoy, who will be speaking tomorrow night as part of the Baltimore Speaker Series. But first, we'll talk a little theater. Stay with us.